All right, my name's Jenna, I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Jenna.
And I want to thank Nikki, sort of, for asking me to come share here tonight. Thankfully, he did not mention this microphone or this recording setup, or I would have been even more self-obsessed than I was. Anyway, I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to just welcome all the people who are in their first 90 days. Those were a rough go of it. I wouldn't recommend it a second time, but I did experience it a second time around. I initially got sober down in Los Angeles when I was, well, about 24 when I first came into the rooms, and I actually came to AA by way of Nicotine Anonymous because I could admit that I had a smoking problem, but I was, like, adamant I did not have a drinking problem. And so my, like, psychiatrist at the time was like, just go to any 12-step meeting, you know, like, please. And so I said, all right, I'm willing to go to Nicotine Anonymous. And I, like, had somebody at work that I really respected and thought was, like, really smart and, you know, like, a good person. And so when she told me she would take me to this meeting, like, I kind of mentioned it, and she pulled me aside and said, like, oh, I know a Nicotine Anonymous meeting. I'll take you. So she was sort of my entry in, and I was just like, I can't believe somebody smart like her would go to one of these 12-step meetings. Like, that was my impression. And I would never have gone otherwise, but this person I respected went, and we sat there, and so I went a few weeks, and I kept relapsing on cigarettes every time I drank, and like, so I went to this guy, and I was like, you know, here's the problem, you know, like, the carrot sticks are fine, and the chewing gum is fine, but like, if you're in like a blackout and you wake up and your cigarettes are all gone, like, what are you supposed to do? Like, it almost doesn't seem fair. You have to start over, you know? So anyway, I was like shaking his hand after he spoke, and I was telling him this, and he was like, he wouldn't let go of my hand. He's like, young lady, he's an old guy, young lady, you need to find your way to Alcoholics Anonymous. Otherwise, you're never going to get rid of cigarettes. And I was like, that's really rude. He doesn't even know me, you know? But he totally did. It turns out that that guy is actually the guy who started Nicotine Anonymous in Los Angeles, but I didn't learn that till like years later. So it's kind of a wild way that AA works. I like was a person who never drank normally my entire life. From my first conscious drink when I was like about 11 or 12, I remember finding this bottle of rum and drinking it and loving it so much. And I remember like having this conscious thought, I need to not drink more because then they'll notice. And if they notice, then they'll take it away and then I won't be able to come back and drink more. So like, that was pretty much my relationship with alcohol all the way through. It didn't ever get any better than that. And Anyway, so I had a whole series of things. I ended up getting kicked out of high school for alcohol, but it wasn't really alcohol. It was because I had other problems, and the school was unfair, and like everything was kind of like that. I never thought alcohol was my problem. It was always my solution, and I was really offended anytime anybody would bring it up, because it'd be like, if you had my problems, you would drink too. In short order, my only thing that was sort of left in my life by the time I was like 24, I like lost this relationship. And I, nobody was really speaking to me. I didn't have any friends, and my family had kind of went away. And so my boss was like, "You have to go see a psychiatrist and go get treatment. Otherwise, we're afraid you're gonna like die." And they were like a psychiatrist and a neuropsychologist, so they like didn't kind of want me to die on their watch. So, and I really like loved them, and they were like my mentors. And so I wanted to do what they suggested. And then my psychiatrist said, "You have to get sober." And so off to AA I went only because I didn't have any other options. And I was given this really incredible life. I got the sponsor, and she like took me through the steps, and we walked through the book. And my first inventory I did with her, she did this like extended third and fourth column. And I had like 96 resentments, some of them with subparts. Like my mom was like person 80. A, B, C, and like wrapped around to AA, A, B, A, C. So I had this like thick, literally almost like 2-inch thick, like, inventory, the first one, and it took us 3 days to read it. It was crazy. But I like, it was the first time in my life that I ever like got all of that stuff out, and I couldn't believe that somebody else like would listen to me for that long, honestly. By the end, even I was like tired of myself, which was pretty hard to do because I'm pretty self-obsessed at times. But even I was like, oh my God, again with this, you know, theme. And I made all these amends, and like my whole world opened up, and I had had this crazy dream in college that I wanted to be a doctor, and then I didn't do well in my classes, and I concluded that I was really stupid instead of concluding, maybe if I attended class and like did the work, I wouldn't have got a D, but instead I concluded like, oh, I'm just not good at physics, like my brain just doesn't work, it's so sad for me, it's tragic really, I can't do the thing I want, you know. And so I would just write poetry and get drunk and cry over these sorts of things. I just really saw myself as this, like, really tragic figure. Like, I wanted all these things, but I couldn't get any of them to work out. And I, like, loved the world, but it didn't love me back. And I loved people, but I couldn't quite connect with them. Or I would connect with them, but then I'd do crazy things in blackouts, and then they wouldn't want to keep connecting with me. And so there was just a whole progression of that until I got sober in AA and was working these steps and, like, had cleaned up all this wreckage, and my family was with me, and I had, like, all these friends, and it was, like, a whole new life that I never thought I could possibly have. Since the time I was really young, I thought, like, oh, I'm going to be one of these people who's dead by the time they're, like, 25. And so I didn't really plan that much for my future, and so there I was, turning 25 and sober, and I'm like, I'm not dead. I remember spending the whole day, I was, like, went to a meeting, and I'm like, I'm going to get hit by a car, it's like, going to get hit by lightning. Like, I felt very jinxed, and it was pretty crazy to me that I, like, celebrated my 25th birthday, and I was sober, and I didn't want to die. Like, I had also spent so many years wanting to die. Like, I would get myself through, like, I'm going to be dead before I'm 25. I can just, like, you know, I'll have to deal with a few more years of this, and then I can kind of check out. And that was kind of how I went throughout my young adolescence all the way through. And, anyway, so I was listening to this woman speak at a meeting, and she was like, maybe some of you have a dream, and maybe you're too afraid to admit it to yourself. And so she had one of these crazy, you know, AA dream come true kind of stories that she talked about. And so I went up, and I was like, great, that's really great, you know, for you. And I do have this kind of crazy dream that I hadn't thought of until I was sitting in a seat. I kind of want to be a doctor, but, like, I'm stupid in physics, and unfortunately, you know. So I told her this little sad story, and she was like, you know, the next time I talk to you, I want to hear, like, what you're doing to make that come true. And I was like, no, you don't understand, because I already failed the classes, so you can't, you know. And so then she was like, okay, thank you, goodbye. You know, because I was, like, in a long line of people thanking her. So I did. I found out that, like, I have to redo, like, all these classes and take more, and so I applied for this, like, kind of post-bac program, and actually applied to a bunch of places, and I wrote them my little sad story. I've actually already taken all the classes that are in your curriculum, but I got, like, C's and D's and F's. Do you mind if I take your whole curriculum again? And a lot of places wrote back, and they were like, no, like, that's not the kind of person we're, you know, that we cater to in our program. But you only need one, is what I learned. And so I got this one, and I actually wrote, you know, my and now I'm sober, and da-da-da, and so this guy, like, was like, you know, I want to meet you, and let's interview and see if you might be a good fit. And so I came up to SFSU for this interview, and I was, he had, like, the circle with the triangle in his, he had all these other symbols, you know, because he was, like, a, you know, masks and art and spiritual kind of, like, biology guy, professor. So he's kind of a kooky guy, and when I saw that, when I walked in the room, I just felt like, oh, it's going to be okay. And so Barry was his name. And so Barry and I got along great, and he invited me up to the program, and I spent, like, 2.5 years, and I was sponsoring all these gals, and I had, like, an H&I panel in the Tenderloin, which made me feel, like, really gritty as I'm, like, going to be this doctor, you know? Anyway, I had this, like, vision of myself. And at the time, I remember saying this, like, prayer when I was in the middle of applying to all these medical schools, like, please, God, like, let me be a doctor, but only if I can be a sober doctor. If I'm not going to be a sober doctor, don't let me be a doctor at all. So it's funny how that all turned out, because, so anyway, I came up here to start medical school about 5 years ago, and I was like, great, AA cured me, I'm so great now, you know, thank you so much. I don't really like the AA in San Francisco, so I'm just going to, like, do it myself. I'll just, like, practice these principles and all my affairs, but, like, by myself. And I did. I was, like, would try to, you know, do inventory in my head during class about something, you know, and then I would, like, insist on making an amends to somebody who's like, I don't know what's going on with you. Like, no, I don't want to have coffee with you. So I had a few of those that were, like, really aggressive. Like, I have to make amends. Because I was just completely trying to sponsor myself, which I do not recommend. Anyway, I, like, had all these times where I would start drinking, and then I, like, wouldn't show up for 3 days, and they would be like, this is completely unacceptable, and, like, I'm so sorry. You know, I was taking care of this, my partner at the time, who was in surgery and all this stuff, so I had, like, a good cover story, but really the truth was I was, like, at home drinking and using drugs, and I couldn't show up for my life, and they excused 17 absences the first year, and I don't know how many they didn't tell me the second year, but by my third year, they were like, absolutely no more. And so they asked me to leave, and I said, but what if I get sober again? Like, you can do whatever you want on your own. So we just need either your resignation or we'll send you one. So I got, as you might imagine, is like my conclusion, though, was, see, I never was good enough. I was never good enough. I was never smart enough. I wasn't, like, good like these people are good. I'm really bad. And I had all this stuff. And it took me a while, like, a few years of more drinking, more using, to finally go, like, maybe I could try to get sober again. And, like, that's the only time in my life where I've ever had any moments of, like, peace and happiness and, like, connection with other people where I don't ruin it with this behavior that half the time I don't even remember. So I had this relationship fall apart about a year and a half ago or a year and 3 months ago. And I was like drinking every day, which I never, when I first came to AA, and I'd hear people tell these stories about like hiding alcohol in their house. I'm like, that's really lame. Like, why you just put it in the freezer? But like, if you live with somebody and you're trying to hide alcohol, that's why you have to hide alcohol. And when you're drinking every day, sometimes, like, I wanted to hide alcohol for myself. I just never thought I'd be a daily drinker. And then it became, like, it's interfering with my sleep. So instead of, you know, on a Saturday starting drinking at, like, 12 or 1, well, if I start at, like, 8 or 9, then I'll be done by 8 or 9, and then I'll be fine with my sleep. Like, this was my thinking. Anyway, that did not work. I kept ordering Postmates in blackout, so I'd wake up and there'd just be like empty bottles on my table, and like, there's like an alcohol fairy, what's going on? And like, how can I control my drinking? I was like making charts of it and graphing to make sure I didn't like go above my average. It was like completely insane. My attempts to control and or enjoy my drinking have never been successful. And I didn't have anywhere else to go. My psychiatrist at the time was like, call a program, like, I can't see you anymore often, like, I don't know what to do. I call this program, and they're like, you have to stop drinking for 2 weeks, and I flipped out of this lady. I was like, I can't do that. I can't even make it one day. What are you talking about? And so I scared her, and she called my doctor and said, I think she needs to be committed. I don't think she's even okay by herself for one day. And I was like, no, I meant, like, I can't handle not drinking for one day. Like, God, this lady's so extreme, you know. So I didn't have anywhere to go because I scared the lady from the outpatient. And I didn't want to go back to inpatient because I've had that experience on multiple rounds, which is a whole other story. And so I came to AA. I was like, I have nowhere else to go, and I can't be by myself all day and all night without drinking. Like, I just have proven that to myself so many times in the last months. And I was out of a job at that point, and so I just tried to make my own outpatient program. I, like, went to this donation-based yoga in the morning, and then I went to a noon meeting, and then I went home, and then I only had, like, a few hours to think about myself and obsess about my problems, and then I go to a night meeting. And so that's what I've been doing, and then I got a job in the spring, and so it's like really a blessing. I had this crazy job with like a 2-hour commute into San Francisco, and I now like live by Berkeley and work at Berkeley like 4 days a week, which means I can still make it to my noon meeting, which was like the first meeting I went back in December. So I don't know what a lot of these things are going to ultimately unfold, but I know that without a doubt, that the only way my life gets better and stays better is when I'm in the middle of AA. And so for that reason, I'm super grateful to be here tonight, and hope you heard something that might be somewhat helpful. Thanks.
I'm David. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I say I'm an addict. I include that in there because when I got sober, people used to like yank us down and like throw keys at us and stuff and make a big deal. Fact is, I would drink, I loved vodka, vodka was my favorite, we'd do vodka shots and take pills at the same time, and we always were like smoking pot and drinking beer. I mean, I don't know about other people, but can't do one without the other, and I don't know what got me drunk first, or loaded first. So I leave that up to other people with bigger minds, but I know that like social drug use does not really work for me, and you know, chipping while I'm drinking, you know, chipping doesn't really work. So that's kind of what that is. And I am 35 years sober. I got sober when I was 24. I'm going to be 60 at the end of the month. Freakish. How did this happen to me? And if anything, if you get anything out of this, it's please, that if anybody can do this, you can do it, because obviously I did it. or I've done it so far. I have drinking and alcoholism on both sides of my family, going way back. Great-grandfathers. In my family, we are super depressed or super anxious and disappointed in life. I have grandfathers on both sides who walked away from families with little children. Like, you know, I'm going out for bread or for cigarettes, and then they never come back. You know, and they leave, like, kids under 10, several of them. And that happened in my parents' generation with mom and her cousins. And it goes even to my generation, where two of my cousins have overdosed because they did not get into the doctoral programs that they expected to get into. And that was their answer. You know, it's kind of like they're disappointed and that's the way to go. I don't know what that is, but I feel it. I totally get it. I have got that stuff going on for me. So my father is super removed. He's emotionally, like, cut off. And my mother was chronically ill, like, from my birth all the way until the time she died. And she sort of rolled that into a rolling drug addiction. I remember being 7 or 8 years old and going to the pharmacy 2 blocks away and, like, waiting to pick up the Darvons because she couldn't get out of bed. You know, I'm walking home and doing that, and it's like, oh, like, I don't know that other kids at 7 or 8 years old, like, that's what they're doing, like, going to the pharmacy, waiting for mom's pills, and picking up a pack of cigarettes on the way home. But I would always pass by this bar that was sort of, was like the neighborhood bar, which was like a black hole with air conditioning and that particular smell that dingy bars have, which is sort of like old beer and, like, stale vomit, you know, and laughing voices in the background, and I just thought, wow. Wow. What's in there? Little did I know. I actually became a bar drinker because I couldn't keep it in the house. I found that out when I was in, when I went off to art school. Within the first couple of weeks of being in art school, I thought, oh, I'm going to pick up a six-pack. That way I'll have beers in the house. On a Saturday afternoon at like 2 in the afternoon, I went home and I popped all those beers and drank them all down until they were gone. And I thought, that's kind of fucked up. So the next time I had some cash, I went over and I thought, I'm going to get a bottle. So I buy a bottle of vodka and I like go home. And funny enough, I like sat down and drank that fucking bottle. And I just thought, I just can't drink at home. That was my answer, and I did, and I never like brought alcohol home. I was always like, I'd take, you know, cash out to the bar, or I'm so old that this is pre-cash machines. You could either write checks at the bar, or you had to bring in your cash. So you either have to make friends with the bartenders, so that they'll take a check, or you go. You know, you make sure you have enough cash to go through drinking through the weekend, because that's like 3 days, and there's nothing worse than Sunday morning coming around. And like, if you gotta go out for brunch, gotta get something going, because it's like my head pounds like crazy. I went off to art school because I couldn't live with my parents anymore. I couldn't take it. They lived in outside of Chicago in Milltown, so it's. And my father worked at the steel mill. And it just, I didn't realize it until years later, after many years of therapy, that it's like, oh, they're living in depression and chronic illness, which is very similar to alcoholism. So I sort of got genetics primed. Thinking I had escaped into art school, I left at 17. I got loaded on my very first day out of my parents' house. My next-door neighbor got me loaded, and I had one of those linoleum floors with like speckles on it, and the floor got up and moved around, and I was just like, I'm there. This is great. This is great. Super competitive. It's a super competitive program. I went to art school and it was competitive. Who knew? But the first year, like, you had to get your shit together, and if you didn't, they have a 50% cut rate. So basically, you're like grinding away at this like kind of art stuff, trying to like make sure that you kept, you know, fit in. I'm the youngest person there in the school. I've always been the youngest in my classes. And, you know, the answer after you get done with your work is everybody goes out and parties all the time. And my drinking was already heavy then, and I was already sort of in trouble. I was a sophomore. Between sophomore and junior years, I'd been going back and forth to my parents' house for summers, putting myself through school, working at the steel mill. I come back from summer. I rent a new apartment. Within a month, I end up being robbed in the apartment. I'm almost murdered. Three men come in, and like they spend 2 hours sort of torturing the people with me and myself. I'm 19 at that point, I think, and I have no skills to deal with it. I have no, like, nothing internally to be able to deal with it. My answer was to drink. Like, my mother, and my family doesn't have that either. My mom's on the phone. She's like, maybe you should see a therapist. And I'm like, no. She's like, okay. I never spoke about it again. Didn't insist on it. Didn't drive down. None of that stuff. It's just like, maybe you should see a therapist. Nah. Drinking super picks up. Drugging super picks up. The thing about Midwestern schools is that everybody's got sibs in other schools, so there's like a drug supply always moving through kind of on a seasonal basis. So, like, if you want anything, it's available, or it was available at that time. I mean, you just sort of put your order in, and, you know, people, like, you know, my cousin's coming from his school in upstate New York. He's going to bring down some LSD. That's great. Okay, great. And there's Quaaludes, like, 15 miles away. Bring those in. Quaaludes were great because you turned into a rubber band, and quite often you could overdose in a really interesting way. And, you know, I ended up being in trouble drinking and drugging right away. I ended up losing my virginity to someone who was as old as my parents and an admitted alcoholic at the time. And I was just like, this is a good sign. I'm really progressing here. My next boyfriend was like an ex-convict who was like kind of crazy, kind of a mistake. Kind of a mistake for like a 19-year-old. And so my thinking and my feeling was kind of really shut down. I don't have internal organization. Like, showing up to art school is my life because there's nothing else really happening that way. Like, you show up to class and do that. But it's not really regulated because people are getting loaded before class. I mean, people are smoking pot at 10 o'clock in the morning. It's like, okay, great. And popping beers for lunch, and then going out later for, like, going on. Find the gay bars. Gay bars are super fun in the Midwest. Creepy and weird. Only goes into it a little bit. And it gets to be that school's finishing up. I'm trying to get into graduate school. I think I'm doing the right thing. I spend more money than I've ever spent before, get into none of them. And I'm like, well, there has to be a back door, because there always is. I'm an alcoholic, and there's an exception. There has to be a way in. I started asking around, and I found someone who knew someone at another school that had an opening, and I got in, and I got a full scholarship based on three pieces of work that was completely different from anything I'd ever done. I go to sign my contract. I take a 4-hour bus where I'm drinking on the bus the entire time. I get off and I've smoked at least three joints between the bus station and the school. I meet the head of the program who is, well, I'm also wearing an orange terry cloth matching beach outfit, flip-flops, and my hair is two colors of like copper penny red and kind of a Dorothy Hamill wedge. And I weighed about 130 pounds, I would say. Yeah. Art students should be skinny and near death. I mean, that's just sort of how they are. And I ended up meeting the head of the program, who's a sculpture department, and the guy is like built like an ape, and he sort of like puts his hand out, sort of, and when he's introduced to me, and he's like, literally, he says to me, he's like, if I had met you 15 minutes ago, before you signed your contract, I would have given it to someone else. Welcome. And I, as fucked up as I was also really mean on another level, and I just thought, fuck you, I'm going to stay here and make your life a misery. Like, that was my job as a graduate student, like, to make this guy's life a misery. So, like, he was a heavy metal sculptor, and I would do things like I would present a paper cup glued to a stool as my sculpture pieces, which made this guy's brain explode. He was just like, I knit like a 14-foot sock, turned that in. It was just like, they were like, what is going on with this guy? And my drinking is like revving up. It's really revving up. And, you know, comes the end of the, I actually stayed, you know, I had the chance to like get out of that situation, and of course I don't take it. I decide to stay. The guy puts me through the ringer trying to get done, and I have a show, like the very last show before the end of the year, and like, you're supposed to write a thesis, which is like a joke. It's like a 30-page paper, and it's a joke. That's what I did. I wrote a joke. Like, I went back and looked at it, like, before I, like, 4 or 5 years later, and it was, like, incoherent, poorly typed. And I had typed this, like, literally on a typewriter. This is how old I am. At least 7 or 8 times, and went through like multiple drafts, submitting multiple drafts, and he always was like, whatever, try it again. And he waited till the very last minute to sign my stuff, so that I had to make a 30-minute trip in like less than 10 in order to be able to meet the deadlines. Like, that was his kicker for me. I had a graduate student show that I took out loans for, spent more money than I'd ever spent before. I had to fill a room twice the size. I started work on the work 6 weeks before the show, because I basically had enough work to fill this table. I stopped really eating. I was drinking espresso coffee and smoking pot and cigarettes for like 6 weeks. And I filled this room with stuff, you know, and one of my advisors was like, best show I've ever seen, this is amazing. It had nothing to do with what my thesis was, but it was sort of like that, there it is. But I also knew that the way to get it over was, like, you have an opening, right? And the professors come and they decide whether they're not going to go with that. So I thought, well, here's the answer. The answer is you don't provide any food and you spend all your money on alcohol. So I bought, like, the handle bottles of vodka and gin and tonic. And I had one of my friends, one of my alcohol friends, come in and, like, pour vodka and tonics and gin and tonics. And to had him go out and buy more. People, like, one of the professors was face down in the front lawn. The other ones were like, best show ever, loved it, this is so great. And I'm taking tabs of acid intermittently, like, every half hour. And then my father and my grandfather and my sister show up. Nothing like talking to your, like, 80-year-old grandfather with the entire world melting behind him. I wasn't sure he was really there. But I know that afterwards there were photographs, so I was sort of like, okay. This isn't really my bottom, but it is sort of my bottom. I'm out of there, and I'm like, I have a graduate degree, and for the next 4 months, I'm like totally flat out. I'm a mess. I can't get a job. People will not even like talk to me. I ended up on welfare. I ended up working like in Ohio on welfare. You have to put in hours of work at some place, like a nonprofit. I ended up working for a woman who was semi-retarded. She was my boss, and she was teaching me how to cook for a group of people in a shelter situation. And I was just like, how did I get here? Like, I'm taking bags of like clothing from the homeless people who are living in the house. That's how, you know, that's how I'm getting my clothing. And I'm sort of like, whoa. And I'm sort of like, when I started to talk to people, I had already been seeing a therapist for like 9 months trying to get through school, and like the therapist had been like, what about this self-destructive drinking? And I was like, what? And she never mentioned it again. But I remember, that's all I remember from like 9 months of therapy, is her asking me that question. What's with this self-destructive drinking? And her writing on there that my drinking had gone from daily to periodic, and I thought, oh, I'm getting better. But actually, if you move from daily drinking to periodic, it means you're getting worse. And you're at the point where when you start to drink, like, you don't know if you're going to get drunk or if you're going to have a lot to drink. And like it starts to be like that I don't know what's going to happen when I'm drinking. It may be that I have a couple beers and all of a sudden I'm gone. And it's 3 days later. Which actually is what happened in Thanksgiving. I had met my first person. Well, one of my girlfriends at that time got picked up for stealing bottles of champagne out of a 7-Eleven. Megan's not here, but she was built like Megan. Like, you could have seen like a pack of cigarettes on this girl, and she had like 3 bottles of champagne under her coat. This is the people I'm running with, obviously. She smarts off to the judge, and he sends her to 3 months, you know, gives her a fine and sends her to 3 months of AA, and she shoots her mouth off, and he gives her 6 months, and she can't stop, and he sends her to a year. So she's all pissed off, and then she's starting to ask people, you know, to go with her, you know, in solidarity and shit. And, you know, it's still the 70s, and or the 80s at that point, and we're all into that. So some of us end up going to a meeting. I literally put my joint out at the doorpost of the meeting. Honest to God, I'm really clear about that one. It was just like, boom. It's a dark basement at Central Service in downtown Ohio. They have tables like this running the entire length, and they're... Everyone is like at least 30 years older than I am, and it's an ugly room. It's just an ugly room, and I'm just like, it's come to this. But we got our seats, and we sat down, and we were like, hee-hee and ha-ha and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, sitting in the back, and like, I heard it. Like, I wasn't even really sure what I heard, but I heard it when people were talking. It was like, oh, it doesn't have to be like that. It can be different. And I was like, I was filled with envy and jealousy. And I didn't even know what they were talking about, but I thought, I have to have that. Whatever that is, I need that. So I started going to meetings, and I tried to get into treatment. Treatment was a new thing then. Liz Taylor was not even sober at that point. Treatment centers hadn't figured out how they could make $1 million out of people. But they did have welfare beds, and they said, oh, sure, we'll get you in the program. You have to stay sober for 6 months. And I was like, if I can stay sober for 6 months, I don't need you fuckers. You know, I was like 3 days sober at that point, and I knew that. So I sort of put that aside. I have no money. I have welfare coming in and food stamps. That's what I'm living on. And started showing up to meetings and going to all, like, 3 and 4 meetings a day, going to, like, everything downtown and then moving farther out, going to young people's meetings, going to LGBT meetings, speaker meetings, topic meetings. Topic meetings are much bigger in the Midwest. That's the bigger deal. Like, it's a social thing to go to a speaker meeting. There's usually maybe one a week. Finding things out about meetings, like, you should be a face at the meeting closest to your house, so that if you break your leg, you can drag your sorry ass to a meeting. And someone will know you there and be able to give you a cup of coffee and say hello. Which I've taken as gospel. On the other side is, I always have a dump meeting, which is a meeting that is so far out where I don't know anyone at all, but I can walk in that door and, like, say anything I need to say. Any poison, I can spew whatever I need to spew without any kind of, like, harsh feelings about it for myself, and I just need, like, and they go, yay, great, nice to hear you. Because I have that. You know, I have that. Sometimes I just don't want to. There's all kinds of stuff that goes on in meetings, and it's like, sometimes you just can't dump it at your house meet, you know, your local meeting or the meeting you do service at. It's embarrassing. I'm steeped in it. My first sponsor pushed us forward to go to all kinds of meetings and to say meeting from preamble to prayer, because every meeting has something for me. Every meeting, even a shitty meeting, has something for me. The problem is that I have to be in my seat to hear it. So if I come late or leave early and I've missed it, that's on me. And even a shitty meeting, possibly a shitty speaker, there's always another speaker. There's always someone else out there that has something to say that I can take with me. And trying to be open to that and to be willing to be changed by AA. The fourth step, I'm totally a crazy person, and I have been super wrapped up that nobody in AA could have helped me. And probably none of the therapy people could have helped me. The only thing that helped me was being able to write my fourth step, or to write about the stuff that's happening in the manner of a fourth step or a tenth step, with an actual piece of paper and a pencil. Actual writing as opposed to typing. It's a completely different thing. I don't know what it is. It's totally AA magic to me. Because just picking that up and putting that pencil under the paper, all of a sudden, you know, 15 pages have come out. And maybe I'm not clear about it, but I have something in front of me, and all of a sudden, like, my tension and my need to drink is over. And I don't really have... it's kind of a serious case with me. I don't really have, like, drinking signals. I have, like, suicide stuff. I'm very clear about that. I have had places and times in my life where I'm walking my dog in the morning, and I walk the dog across the street, and I go to the light to cross the street, and I think I need to step in front of the bus. What the fuck is that? But it's there. And I'm like, oh, there's something else going on. You know, it's not like I need to drink. It's like, no, I need to, like, throw myself in front of the bus. And that was, like, at 18 or 19 years sober. I've been in a zillion kinds of therapies, all kinds of crazy meetings. sponsored people, been sponsored by people, fired sponsors, hired sponsors, fired sponsees, done service, I've been a treasurer, been a, you know, co-chairs, led speaker meetings, worked on campaigns for conferences, all kinds of conferences, done all kinds of stuff in terms of that, and tried to get out into the bigger AA world, which there is. Like, I've been to meetings in Europe, South America, all kinds of stuff, and trying to reach out and find those other stories, because even in stuff where people are completely different from me, which is really great, I really look to go to meetings where people are completely different, because then I'm not up in their shit, and it's like, oh, I'm just getting the straight program. That's all I can hear, because I don't know, I'm not into their stuff. You know, whatever that, you know, boyfriend, girlfriends, or economics, or their trouble within their situation, or their place, or home, or whatever. It's like, oh, you know, grandpa in the middle of the Richey suburb, like, I don't even know what that life is, but he's talking about AA, and I can hear that. I can hear that for myself, and take that home for me, and make that work for me. Trying to have myself be open to the change. I always want to know how to go forward. How do I go through this day? How do I meet this day? I just want to wrap up with, I just left my job of 11 years. I guess I am retired. I don't know what that means. I'm just finished like 2 weeks of a vacation break, giving myself a vacation on it. My husband of a couple years is 5 years into dementia. And I decided that it's time to like move on with that. And trying to find my way forward, like, how do we do this? What's not what I expected. People in my support groups, the dementia caregiver support groups are all, they fall into two categories, either people who've got their stuff together, which I don't really understand, and I'm trying to be one of those people, or people at the beginning where they're like wrapped up in what they're losing and their disappointments. And I totally know what that is. You know, they're like, I didn't marry this guy so I could take care of him for like 15 years while he loses his mind and I have to like wipe his diapers. You know, I'm like, I don't want to be those people. I want to move forward. How do I meet my situation in my day? You know, somebody has to make dinner, and that's me. You know, how do I do that? So I'm sort of picking my way and pushing my way through. I got through with my job and I trained my new boss. I trained the woman who's going to come after me. You know, and I'm trying to like figure out my situation at the moment and to be as open to what's in front of me, because this is all I have and this is all we have, is this moment. Like, I'm really clear that everybody has a higher power. That's what I love about AA meetings, is that, like, it's 40 people's higher powers are in the room, and then you sort of go out into it. And AA for me is quite often, it's like the locker room at a football game. Sports metaphors that I know nothing about. But you're out in the world and you get the shit kicked out of you, and then you come into AA meetings and people sort of, like, bandage you up, pat you on the head, and, like, pat you on the butt and send you back out, you know, with like good words to be able to meet the situation. And it's like, that's what I do. That's how it's done. It's not any magic thing. Although magic is quite amazing. I have seen people come in who have the kind of filth ground into their skin from years of living on the street and sit at meetings and drink the coffee and eat a cookie for years. And then one day they walk in and they're, like, shaved and sober. How the fuck did that happen? How does that happen? You know, they sit in the room and they pick up one word a year, maybe, and all of a sudden it's don't drink. Oh. Oh. You know, because it's been like that for me, too. My fervent wish is that you stay sober today and you find a way to go forward. And in a heartfelt way, too, is that making room for the people who walk into the room who are not like you. So that, you know, the unattractive person, the old person, the damp brain damaged person, or the crazy person has a seat. They have just as much right to be in here, and like, get them a cup of coffee and say hello. It's not that hard. It's no skin off your ass, really, really. And it's amazing what it can do for your recovery. To be the hand of AA. AA is not given to me. I am part of AA, and I'm one of the people who puts it on. You know, I pick up the chairs. I hope you do too, or make the coffee, or do the treasury. Don't just be here like getting it. Be here like making it happen. Thanks.